to the official SBGN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Dr. Alex Nicely with Dr. Lorenzo Norso. Norso sounds a lot like Urso, but we're not going to be talking about bile acids today, or only secondarily. Dr. Norso's specialty is in short bowel syndrome. Short bowel syndrome, or rather in short bowel disorders, or intestinal insufficiency. And most children with intestinal insufficiency that is of clinical import don't have autoimmune enteropathy. They don't have various metabolic disorders. Instead, they've suffered a surgical accident or a developmental accident that has robbed them of adequate small bowel capacity to sustain life. But now there's teduglutide. And if you were only here in the recording studio, you know how I've grappled with that word. Teduglutide is something, instead of filleting the bowel and stitching it back together in interesting configurations, lengthening procedures, and something different from small bowel transplant, it actually allows the bowel to grow, and to increase in surface complexity in a manner that permits even small quantities of bowel better to support life. Tell us more about this wonder drug.
Yes. Thank you very much for the introduction. Teduglutide is a new pharmaceutical compound, which is actually coming from the study of GLP-2, which is a hormone, glucagon-like peptide 2 is a hormone which is particularly having an impact into the growth of enterocytes. Glucagon-like peptide 2 is a remaining of the proglucagon degradation, and it has actually some receptor which are into the enterocytes. And when GLP-2, we will call it GLP-2 for the sake of our audience, when GLP-2 is going to their receptor, it will increase enterocyte mutation and it will decrease enterocyte apoptosis. And this will increase our percentage of it will elongate our bowel in a way, and it will also help us to grow our villi more deep and to have our crypt, which are more deep into our intestine.
So this all occurs at the level of the plicae circularis, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so we have first more enterocytes.
Yes.
And second, the enterocytes are piled higher.
Exactly.
And the enterocytes go down deeper.
Exactly.
We have longer villi, deeper crypts. And it does this by increasing the mitotic activity within these cells and damping apoptosis.
Exactly. This is in his physiological way. And this is something that we have been knowing in his physiological compound from the first 2000. And now we had the chance to have a new drug which is mimicking this GLP-2, which are GLP-2 analogs. And this is teduglutide, which we are speaking of. And actually, teduglutide is the same composition of the hormonal GLP-2, but we had a change in one of the amino acids, which making a mimicking GLP-2 for our patients with short bowel syndrome.
You say drugs. Does that mean that, let's just call it capital T, does that mean the capital T is only the first in a series of similarly active drugs?
Yes, probably yes, because this is there is research now on similar type of drugs which are long acting GLP-2 analogs. So teduglutide is just the first that was discovered from a group of researchers in Denmark in adult gastroenterology. The group led by Professor Jeppesen in Copenhagen. And now they are working on other kind of GLP-2 analogs and even other hormones mimicking and enhancing intestinal absorption, like GLP-1 or a combination of GLP-2 and GLP-1.
I think that anybody listening to this podcast will be very well advised to find any Danish pharmaceutical firm and buy stock, because they're coming up with some lovely things. Look at Ozempic. If only we'd bought stock in the Ozempic manufacturers, we could just go to the yacht salesman and say, we want it this long. But which goes to by way of saying that capital T is an awfully expensive drug, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is an expensive drug right now, and we know that it is a very expensive drug in the market. But now we are starting to have some evidence also about the impact of this drug on the socio-economical market, because you have to know that parenteral nutrition dependency has a very, very big impact into our life, not only a direct impact on the life of the patients and on our, I would say, economy, but it has all the indirect cost of being at home with parenteral nutrition every night, of not being in the community, of maybe not being able to work. So you have always to balance which are the direct and the indirect cost of parenteral nutrition and the direct cost of the drug, of course.
Oh, I'm not questioning that teduglutide is a major, major advance, and it offers not just it offers benefits not just to the patient and the patient's family, but to those around the patient. No question about that. But I'm saying now, I've been on teduglutide for several months, maybe even several years. When do I finally say, hey, you know, my gut is long enough? When do I stop?
This is a very tricky question and very difficult to answer right now. We have, I think, in pediatrics, we have something which is a bit that can help us a bit, because we are dealing with the period of life where we have a very different and increasing needs of calories. But these needs will finish probably at the end of puberty. So in this period in particular, patients with short bowel syndrome have difficulties to grow because they don't have enough energy from their short bowel in order to get their puberty done and to become adult. Then at the end of puberty, I think that probably those patients will achieve a normal growth. And then it may be that we could eventually, because we don't know yet, because this is a new drug, stop the treatment and see if they can continue their life without treatment. But this is still undergoing, because this treatment has been off only from 5 years in the European market. So we're still questioning ourselves of an exit strategy to the treatment.
What's your anecdotal experience with patients who, for one reason or another, had to discontinue capital T?
My experience when I discontinue teduglutide in patients which needed teduglutide is that they revert exactly to the same status they were. But this was not made in patients which were adult. Now, I'm the head of a project taking a big registry of pediatric patients on teduglutide, which is a European registry, ESPGAN sponsored. sensor registry in which we stock data from more than 100 patients from all over Europe. And so now we will probably have more data on what to do, when to stop, when to start, and which are the predictive factor of response to this treatment.
It's fascinating that the bowel reverts to its status ante quo. That suggests to me that increase in enterocyte surface area is not paralleled by increase in, say, smooth muscle quantities in the, perhaps in the muscularis mucosae, but not in the muscularis externa. Have I inferred correctly?
Yes, you have inferred really correctly, because the I would say the absorptive bowel capacity is due to the villi and to the enterocyte. But the enterocyte has a life cycle which is short. And so if we don't feed them, I would say feed them into brackets with GLP-2, they will probably go back to their own status of being apoptotic and without this in-house mitosis. Tedoglutide is not right now, but then we will maybe have new treatment. It's not giving right now permanent remodel of our intestinal surface.
Well, that's disappointing, isn't it? Let me take the question a little bit further back along the line. What physiologically, in the untreated patient, in the person who's just going along and growing along, stimulates the release of glucagon-like peptide 2? What is it? Is it formed in the pancreas, in the pituitary? Is it an endocrine or a paracrine drug? Where does it come from?
It comes from the gut, from the brain-gut axis, because actually it comes from the pituitary cells, and it forms the degradation of glucagon. But then. Yes. GLP-2 goes really, the receptor of GLP-2, we were mapped, and the biggest part of receptor for this GLP-2 which was degraded by glucagon are in the enterocytes itself. The only thing which is really important to know is that they are usually in the enterocytes of the last part of the short bowel and the beginning of the colon. So if we have, there are types of short bowel syndrome which tends to respond anatomically better to the treatment, because they do not have any endogenous GLP-2, which is, I would say, competing with the drugs. And so this helps in some of the patients.
Well, thank you. But the question remains open for me. When do you elect, and at what stage in the evolution of short bowel syndrome do you give capital T?
So we have to know that in our adaptive intestine, we have the first 5 years of life are crucial into adaptation, even in patients with short bowel syndrome. And probably this is due to endogenous GLP-2, as we said. So there are different, I would say, clinical use of GLP-2 in different centers. But in our experience, we tend to use GLP-2 when we are sure that all the adaptation of the intestine has been done, and then that we are still on parenteral nutrition and we didn't achieve any autonomous weaning, I would say, because there are many patients we know with short bowel syndrome, approximately 50 or 60% can be weaned autonomously without any treatment. So for those patients, for those 40 or 30% which cannot be weaned normally, and they could be good candidates for a pharmacological weaning.
So it's a matter of, as the UK advertising slogan used to go, it's a matter of suck it and see. Just give it a try, see if parenteral alimentation can be successfully withdrawn without unduly stressing the patient. And if it indeed can, although we haven't defined the criteria for it can be withdrawn, then you say, I guess the teglutamide days are over. All right, fair enough. How many patients are you running on this at your own institution?
Right now at my own institution, there are approximately 7 or 8 patients on teduglutide, only children. And in Europe, as I said, we have over 100 patients. But it needs to be said that the market in Europe and the authorizational use of teduglutide in Europe is still scattered, because some of the countries can use it because it's reimbursed. Some other countries in Europe cannot use it yet. So it's still, I would say that it depends on where you were born, if you can have access to teduglutide treatment.
Aren't there provisions in the European Union that say if you can't get it at home, you can go abroad?
Yes, but not for this kind of life of chronic treatment. Right now it is not really possible to get someone from abroad in order to have teduglutide in Italy if he do not get the authorization, like being, I would say, covered by our national insurance.
I foresee a brisk upturn in Italian adoption rates, but perhaps that's a different way of approaching the situation. How are the families responding to the introduction of this agent?
It has to be said that teduglutide is now only a subcutaneous treatment, and so it leads to injection every day. Mm-hmm. So we need to know that for children, this is something which can impact heavily also their quality of life. But in the other way around, we are speaking about children which has a high impact on their quality of life, or being on parenteral nutrition and with a central venous catheter. So families are responding quite good when the treatment is working. Of course, they put a lot of input into the treatment because they always hope that this could solve their problem. It is not always the case, but this is something that should be said to all the families, because it is not a treatment of one size fits all. It's a treatment which has rate of response around 60% when we define the response as a reduction of PN calories or PN volume of 20%. But when we think about weaning, so taking out the whole parenteral nutrition, then the weaning rate is approximately in our registry 20%. So we're
1 in 5.
Exactly.
What are some of the reasons for failure of treatment?
This is something we are studying on, because
Is it immunogenic, for example?
There are probably also immunogenic factors which were studied in the clinical trial from Jeppesen, but it depends on which kind of responders we are speaking of, because they are responder which lose response, and which probably are the loss of response could be immunogenic, but there are also patients with do not acquire response in the first place. And so we need to understand, and this is our job in our registry, to try to define predictive factors for response to the teduglutide, and which are the main biochemical markers that we can see in the first 6 to 6 months or 1 year of treatment that could predict us patients which will go to winning course.
There's clearly an awful lot more that needs to be said, not just can be said, but needs to be said about this agent and the hope that it offers and the disappointments that it may offer as well. But as so often with these podcasts, we've taken up a fascinating theme and then run out of time. I'm sorry. It's time to ask you, have you chosen a song?
Yes, I've chosen a song which matters to me for his text, because it's called Piccola Stella Senza Cielo, and it means little star without a sky, a bit like our patients with short bowel syndrome that are trying to find their sky, and we will probably help them with treatments and new drugs.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Fingers crossed, and may God speed your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.